everyone, to this week's episode of Mention and Dispatches. I'm Brant. I'm your host, Bayonet Brant on the forums. With me tonight, one of my fellow Dragoons, BB Mike. Mike, how are you doing tonight?
I am doing great tonight. Thank you.
And we can hear you tonight, which is awesome. Yes. Yes.
You know, well, if I'm going to co-host these things, I got to sound good, right?
Yeah, well, you know, why start now? Also joining for a return engagement, we had him here last year to talk about Matt Caffrey's On Wargaming book, but our buddy Chris is back, professional DoD wargamer type and all-around sci-fi geek. Chris, how you doing?
I am doing excellent. Excellent. Yeah, Thank you for having me.
Oh, now love having you here. I've known Chris probably going back at least 15 years when he used to be a regular on panels that I would – I'm holding up air quotes. I would moderate at Origins. And really what that meant is I would introduce the speakers and immediately lose control of the room. So it was good fun. And then tonight, a first timer here on Mention and Dispatch, which is the first timer on any of our podcasts. A good buddy, author, former coworker of mine, Henry Vogel is joining us. And Henry is a sci-fi author. And so we thought we'd bring him in because we're doing sci-fi stuff tonight. Henry, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Happy to be here. Looking forward to the discussions and hoping I can convince a few people to go buy some of my books.
Yeah. Speaking of that, let's get the obvious shilling out of the way up front. The latest of the sci-fi books to drop was which one?
The absolute latest is called Fortune's Fool, which I released under a pen name because it uses language that I have never used before in previous books. So it's under the name Jeff Boyd. There is I won't even go into the pun behind the last name, but that's B-O-Y-D, Boyd. And it's Fortune's Fool, which was my attempt at a sort of a 1930s, 1940s pulp science fiction adventure. There are no spaceships in it at all.
That one's a little grittier than your usual books.
Yes, it is. It's grittier. The language is... earthier, as one of the reviews put it. The hero is a little less straight and narrow. Not that all of mine are straight and narrow, but he's a little more bent and more willing to take deadly force where necessary against those who oppose him.
And what's funny is just knowing how many of the same people we all know, if I were trying to think of people with whom we had worked that he could have been inspired by, it's not a short list.
No, right? It's not. It's not at all. And quite frankly, I drop fewer F-bombs in 50 some odd thousand words of of story than our friend Ross drops in a lunchtime.
Yes, yes. Well, that's because we spend most of lunchtime trying to mess with him while gaming.
No, there is that, yes.
Of your Sword and Planet series, your sort of space opera, traditional pulpy sci-fi stuff, not the more grown-up focused ones, what was the last one to come out? Was it Fugitive Air?
Oh, God, no. The Fugitive Air came out in 2016.
That was a while ago.
Thanks, Brant. Now I know who's not buying my books. The last one to come out was... hang on. I have my handy dandy list.
Dude, I have most of them on the Kindle. The problem is because I have most of them on the Kindle, I don't know what order they were all in.
I can fix that for you.
I'm sure
the last one to come out is actually called Heart for Adventure, which is one of the scout novels. That's Sword and Planet. It's sort of the whole series is kind of my homage to Edgar Rice Burroughs and Lee Brackett's Sword and Planet, or Planetary Romance, if you prefer, books. The book that Heart for Adventure is, and that's H-A-R-T. It's the character's last name. But anyway, it's kind of a prequel to the whole series, although it doesn't hurt you any if you read the whole series beforehand. There's six books in the series, and I'm currently writing a seventh.
Yeah, you've got the Fugitive series, you got the Scout series,
the Recognition series.
Yep.
There's a couple of books in the Captain series, which could be called part of the Fugitive series because the Captain is a spinoff from the Fugitive Air. And yep. Then there is the Lost Planet, which is currently a standalone book. It does finish the story, although there will eventually be at least one sequel to that.
So let's hold all those thoughts for a second, because we're going to circle back around to how some of your books may get rolled into some gaming if folks were looking for that kind of adventure. But before we went on the air, we were talking a little Star Trek-ness, and we've got space combat folks and Star Trek fans and Henry Wright and his Sword and Planet stuff. And so I think it's pretty obvious to all of our listeners at this point, this is one of our sci-fi podcast. And Mike, you've been around for pretty much the life of all of the podcasts we've been working on. I don't know that we've ever done like a sci-fi focused one before, have we?
Not specifically. We've talked sci-fi a little bit, Starfleet battles and novels and movies, but we've never had a sci-fi only podcast. This is a first.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that we've ever specifically focused on it all. And so to that end, like one of the reasons I went and called Chris, besides the fact that he's just an all around great podcast guest, Chris, you tend to show up on guest lists for sci-fi conventions quite frequently as a dude who's an expert in space combat. And so I got to ask sort of, how does one become an expert in space combat? How does this happen? Given that, to my knowledge, there hasn't actually been any to this.
That's a good question. What I really think is my strength is that I can think about real world navies and science fiction navies at the same time. For six years, I worked at the Center for Naval Analysis for Peter Perla, who in the gaming field is a name to conjure with. But I was also the crazy guy you could get to go ride a ship on 2 weeks' notice. And so I did lots of exercise reconstruction. So, you know, they'd send me out onto an aircraft carrier for 2 weeks, and I'd be out there with my notebook watching what the anti-submarine warfare people were doing on the exercise. But as I tell people, I always had two notebooks on board, one that I was using to collect data that we'd use in the exercise reconstruction, and another one that I was using to collect, you know, just factoids and stuff about the ship, because I had a couple of friends who were science fiction authors, and I wanted to be able to pass that information along to them. And I had a couple of friends who were science fiction authors because of the internet, right? The internet's this wonderful thing where you discover that you really like an author, and you can track them down and send them a note and saying, hey, I think your work is really great, et cetera, et cetera. And a couple of those times it sort of blossomed into more of a friendship, to the point where, like, when Dave Trowbridge and Sherwood Smith did the second edition of their Exordium books, I'm one of the two people they dedicated the second edition to. And that all started with me sending a note to Dave Trowbridge saying, hey, I think you're doing great stuff. Please keep it up. My game design partner, Arius Kaufman, and I designed a game in that universe. Maybe someday it'll get released, but it sort of fell into the black hole of agents and stuff like that. So it just happened that, you know, I like talking about those subjects. I like doing it in public. I got linked into some science fiction conventions. And one of the things is, once you've done one science fiction convention, you then go to the next one and say, I was a professional guest at this con. You should let me into your con. And the dirty little secret is they're looking for people who can get up in front of a room and say things that they think might be interesting. So at the time, I was a professor of wargaming at the Naval War College. It helps if you say it with a deeper voice. And, you know, I spent time on aircraft carriers, et cetera, et cetera. And I was able to talk my way into these things, and now it's one of my primary hobbies.
Now you can't get out of it.
Yeah, and since then, you know, Michael Peck interviewed me twice for the foreign policy blog on the subject of starships. I think I'm the only person who's ever talked about starships on the foreign policy blog, and I've done it twice. One was called Enterprise versus Enterprise, and it was about Star Trek, and the other one was basically it's the online version of a talk I do called What the U.S. Navy Taught Me About Starfleet. And then the other one was called Aircraft Carriers in Space. And it was just basically about Battlestar Galactica. And I spend a lot of time thinking about real world navies and thinking about science fiction navies and trying to make science fiction better by applying some of the things that I've learned in the real world.
Of interest, you mentioned Battlestar Galactica. The great thing about having over the air television just plugged in, I've got Comet on one of the HD sub channels out here in the game den, and there's an episode of Battlestar Galactica on right now as we speak.
Which episode?
Chief Tyrrell is busy being court-martialed for something or other. It's
I would have asked which Battlestar, because I'm that old.
Yes, well, the so the original Battlestar Galactica was like goofy, campy fun because it was clear they were trying to ride the Star Wars coattails. But I think most folks who had spent much time in or around the military really appreciate the grittier reboot from about 10 years ago. And I'm really dreading whatever the hell NBC is about to do for another reboot on this Peacock streaming service and just really kind of wanting to avoid it at all costs. So,
you know, maybe, you know, I'll wait and see what they do with it. I don't think that the 2004 reboot was perfect by any stretch of the imagination. It's got a lot of really good things going for it, and it convinced me to have cable longer than I would have normally. It had some really great stuff, and there's some, you know, Ron Moore wanted to go to the Naval Academy, and he somehow ended up in Hollywood instead. And there's a lot of things in there that I really, really like. And I knew that I was really going to like the miniseries when early on at one point you hear them come over the 1MC, which is the ship-wide public address system, and they start talking about there are men working in suits outside the spacecraft. Do not radiate, blah, 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 blah. There are men working in suits. And that's exactly the sort of thing that you hear on a U.S. Navy warship. When they do something like that, it is always phrased exactly the same way. It is what they refer to as a litany. You do not deviate from it. It is always said exactly the same way. And it's, you know, they're reading a script. And that script is like, you know, written by higher officials. If it's a tactical sort of thing, it's actually written by the people that write the tactics manual. And the Navy has these things. So like one of the ones that you hear every day is, sweepers, man your brooms, give the ship a clean sweep fore and aft, sweep it, and then it lists all the different places you're supposed to sweep, and it says sweepers, man your broom. And it's just referred to as sweepers, right? Oh, you know, better hurry up, it's almost time for sweepers, that sort of thing. And the fact that they did that they took that attention to detail about just something that was just going on in the background told me that they had done their homework.
Yeah.
And I went, this could be really good. They're pretty good on a lot of other stuff too. Like when they talk on the radio, like every now and then when Adama gets on the radio, he says, this is Galactica actual.
Yep.
And anybody who's been in the military recognizes that a lot of times you'll hear somebody say, you know, this is Seventh Fleet. And what it really means is it's one of the people who are on the staff. But if it says this is Seventh Fleet actual, you're talking to a 3-star.
Yes. I've had to use the actual call sign a couple of times because in the ground force world where vehicles have their call signs, sometimes when you hear things on the net, you're not sure if it's the vehicle or the person.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in the parlance of the Dragoons, I would be Dragoon 6 as the commander. But if I had a vehicle out there with me, Dragoon 6 could also refer to the bumper number on the vehicle. That when you're on the radio, you know, hey, who is this? This is Dragoon 6, or this is Dragoon 6 actual. This is me speaking, not just whoever. So.
Yeah, and one of the things that there. You see in the Navy, there's something called Composite Warfare Commander Doctrine, which is basically how a carrier strike group operates. And it basically boils down to you've got warfare commanders who cover the different types of warfare you might run into, anti-submarine warfare, air defense, all that stuff. And then you've got the admiral who gives his intent, and then he practices command by negation. And you've got the subsidiary guys who are basically running the show, and they're all 06s. But there's the main ones, but then there's some other call signs that go in there too. Like for one is, I think the screen commander is November. And so you might have like Zulu, this is Bravo Zulu, that's the Sea Combat Commander, blah, 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 blah. And then the exact same guy will say break November, this is Bravo November, blah, 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 blah. And it's, I was wearing one hat talking to a big group of people, and now I'm wearing another hat talking to a smaller group of people. You know that it's the same person talking, right? They're not trying to hide that. But you also know that by switching hats, he's switched topics. He's switched areas of responsibility. And by switching call signs when he does the call out to the group, he's talking now about the subset of guys that are forming the screen around the aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
And so he's not talking about the big group. And so my mission in life is to A, know about stuff like that, and B, tell it to science fiction people. I've been talking with John Hemery, aka Jack Campbell, who wrote the Lost Fleet series, and I've made the argument to him that that composite warfare commander doctrine would apply in his universe, because one of the sort of pillars of the justification for CWC doctrine was that it was designed to deal with jamming. And in his universe, you've got ships that are dealing with communication lags because they're very far apart from each other. And light speed lag is a thing in that universe. And as a result of that, you know, if you kind of squint a little bit, communication lag and jamming looks an awful lot alike. Takes a while to get the message through to people.
Yep.
You better not be dependent upon a system that requires timely orders from above. So you have to design your system so that parts of it can survive without being able to phone home for instructions all the time.
And that's where your battle drills come in as well.
Yeah, you got to be drilled. You got to have pre-planned responses. You got to have tactics, techniques, and procedures that you can plug in so that people know what to do. And you need to have a chain of command that degrades gracefully. And by that, I mean, if you can't get through or you're separated, you need to know who's next in line. I was on an aircraft carrier one time, the last deployment of Constellation, an exercise she did right before she did her last deployment, where she had a main space fire. And we hadn't lost power, and we ended up not losing power, but there was always the danger we were going to lose power. And so they said, this is an excellent time to test the alternate commander. And so they basically told the alternate commanders, you've got it. And the main commander and his staff just sort of stood back and listened as the other people ran the program for about 5 hours or so. And they have their own call signs. So if you hear that, you know, I forget what they are, I'd have to look it up. But if you hear this particular call sign, what you know is that is the alternate Sea Combat Commander. By virtue of the fact that he's on the net using that call sign, you know the Sea Combat Commander is not in a position where he can run the problem himself. He might be listening.
Main guy's down.
Yeah. So devolves to the next lower level. And you also know that, you know, the Sea Combat Commander actually wears a couple of other hats, but when they go down to the next level, they split those hats up because it's more than, you know,
it's more than one guy can handle.
A captain who's not running a ship, a post command 06 with a staff, can wear all those hats. When you start saying, oh yeah, ship driver, as your collateral duty, you're now running the problem. At that point, you have to start breaking that stuff up.
Too much. So with all of that, we're going to circle back into how some of that actually happens in the wargaming world. But Mike, based on what you know and have seen and have played with in the sci-fi world, some of those crossovers between what happens in the real Navy versus what you see happening in space. And I know the Navy is not your main shtick, but you've been exposed to it some, as well as through wargaming. What are your reactions to some of what Chris is throwing out there?
You mean as far as in terms of war games that I played, or just?
Well, just in general, as a fan of science fiction as a whole, we'll circle back around to the gaming component here in a few.
Oh, as far as what he said is concerning science fiction novels, I mean, that's like 100%, 1,000% agree. And I'm glad to hear him say that, because I think lately it seems that I'm not so sure about writers as much, but certainly Hollywood has kind of ignored that. There are exceptions like Battlestar Galactica, but for the most part, I think Hollywood has gone off the rails, and that they need to get back to little details like he was pointing out, you know, the way the military would actually call out something over speakers in the background. That's the kind of stuff I love to hear. That that's the realism that just makes it that much better.
Henry, I know that those sorts of fleet level actions are not a common feature of your stories, but some of the actions on the ships themselves while traveling, or some of the actions of the characters within the stories where they're in the context of a larger hierarchy or such, What, if any, sorts of concessions have you made to moving the story along to sort of blow off some of the realism piece versus let's make sure we get this stuff in here to sort of set the stage for the read?
Well, one of the books that I released earlier this year, the one just before Heart of Adventure, was called Scouts Training, which was kind of a handoff to, you could call it Scouts, the Next Generation, if you want to. But it was set in an academy, not a semi-military academy. And I wrote that with no research, just wrote it off the top of my head. And one of my beta readers is, he's retired now, but he was a 20-year naval vet. He'd probably go great on this program because he was in subs and he used to do a lot of wargaming near the end of his career, designing wargaming, things like that for the subs. But he read through that. And he basically ripped up a whole conflict situation I had that represented the entire middle third of the book. And he said, no, it's not like that in the military. You're not going to find that going on. This may be what you've got going on. No. And he's my primary source for any kind of military information along that line. I ended up rewriting the entire middle of the book to bring it in line with his recommendations. He was talking about a lot of different things that he saw. I had written in some prejudices. They were not racial. They were more lost colonies versus core world sort of things. You know, the Hicks versus the, so to speak, versus the elites from the you know, Earth or other longtime settled worlds. And there was a lot of prejudice that was in there. And he said, you're not going to find that in the military. The military was for him. He said, like, these are the people you depend on. Your life depends upon them at some points. And you cannot afford to go through with the kind of prejudices that you're showing in there. People learn who's good at something. And if they're good at something, then they pay attention to it and they pay attention to what that person says. And like I said, I ended up rewriting, basically I yanked the entire middle of the book out and wrote it again to fit in with his feedback. But that's really the only time I've done that, because that's really the only time I've had a serious military connection, despite the fact that my captain books has, she's a captain in the Navy. She was a fighter pilot, but all of her stuff happens outside of any kind of regular chain of command. She's mostly operating on her own. So I didn't have to worry about getting the military right with her.
Yeah. You, your stories don't really take place in a military setting. So, you know,
no, they don't. And
there's a lot less of that detail that would be present, huh?
Right. And I generally concentrate on a small number of characters, usually 2 to 4 characters. In The Lost Planet, I had 6 or 7 that were working together. But for the most part, it is still a small unit and non-military.
Yep. Yep. Totally. So going back to some of the bigger pieces, like Chris was talking about, one of the challenges you run into in some of the wargaming component of this is that, Chris, I think you'll attest to this also, a lot of these space combat wargames are essentially naval wargames with a black background, right? Instead of a blue background. And part of that is probably just due to the analogs between sort of Space Navy versus Wet Navy. But it always seems as though some of the things that you can take advantage of based on the expectations of advanced technology in, you know, if you can fly through space, you've got all these other things that should be available to you and yet don't seem to be either in movies or in wargaming. In part because they're just not sexy enough. And Chris, this goes back to one of the things you had done on a previous broadcast I was watching. One of the ones you were talking about is space combat in Star Trek always seems to involve, you know, near collision passes and essentially throwing rocks at each other, in part because it looks good on the screen. Whereas if you've got the technology to travel, you know, in a warp bubble faster than the speed of light, you've probably got the technology to target somebody beyond visual range. which looks like crap on screen, but is a far more realistic implementation of the technology. So how do we get away from the Hollywoodization of those things on, you know, that we see on screen into our wargaming, into our games and our actual, you know, sort of playing these things out?
I think the first step is to understand why naval combat is the way it is. And therefore, once you've done that, you can figure out what parts of it, if you want to use it as a model, that's fine. But you need to figure out what parts of it translate, what parts of it need some massaging to translate, and what parts of it don't translate. And I always talk about something called the three H's in a lot of my talks. And the three H's are history, hiding, and hydrodynamic. And the history part is about how warships develop over time and like what an escort is versus what an auxiliary is, because they're really not the same thing. You can look at like frigates in the Age of Sail and draw a comparison to like destroyers in the fleet in World War II, and that comparison is wrong. It's just plain wrong. The roles are very different. They're not analogous at all. In the Age of Sail, you wouldn't stick a frigate in the line of battle if you had regular line of battle ships. There are no frigates in the line at Trafalgar. There are frigates there, but they're standing off. You don't put them in the line. Whereas in a war fleet from like World War I on, destroyers, etc., are part of the battle force at the time. They are participants. They're not just watching. They have a role to play. A lot of times you see ship types that are just like Star Trek is one of the worst offenders about this, where it's just a copy paste from a World War II list of ship types into Star Trek. But I always wonder, it's like, what are those other ships doing? I understand what a destroyer does in World War I, and I understand what a destroyer does in World War II, and it's largely the same thing. And I understand what a destroyer does today, and it's kind of the same thing. But I don't understand what a destroyer does in the Star Trek universe. I just don't see what it does. What makes it different?
It destroys things.
It might be that it
clearly,
yeah,
it's in the name. It destroys things.
That could be. And it seems that in Star Trek, it's really you see this in a lot of science fiction where it stops being about the role and it starts being about how big it is. And so a destroyer becomes a ship that's in between a frigate and a cruiser in size. And a cruiser is a ship that's in between a destroyer and a battle cruiser in size. And it's really all about size. It's not about role. But in the real world, destroyers and cruisers and battleships had much different jobs to do. It wasn't just that one was big and one was small. It's that they were designed to do different things. I talked about the three H's. Another one is hiding. There are four ways that a ship can hide or a fleet can hide. It can hide behind the curve of the Earth, behind what I call the interface barrier, which means that, you know, you've got ships that are, you've got vessels that are in the air, on the surface, or under the sea. And as a general rule, a sensor that works in one of those environments doesn't work in another. So you generally have to poke something through, i.e. like a periscope, right? That's how a submarine sees into the realm of the air or through the air and sees stuff on the surface. In the case of an airplane, you drop a sonar buoy into the water so that you can listen to the submarine, because sonar does not transition through that barrier. Radar does not transition through that barrier. You can hide through the use of time and space, just basically distance. It's a big ocean. Your sensors have a certain field of view, and it can be hard to find. Did I mention hiding behind the curve of the Earth? I don't think I have yet.
You did.
Oh, okay. But I didn't really say anything about it. But you can hide, go beyond the horizon, and you become surprisingly hard to see. And the last thing is you can use a low observable technology, aka stealth. You can do stuff to reduce your signature and make it harder for them to find you. It doesn't make you impossible. Well, okay, so there's no hiding behind the curve of the Earth in space. You've only got one media. You can talk about hiding behind planets, but if you sort of do the geometry a little bit, and it doesn't work, right? If for no other reason, then you need to know exactly where the sensor is that you're trying to hide from in order to put a planet between you and it. And how do you know where that sensor is? Well, because you probably saw the ship that had it, at which point he saw you too, right? So you're just guessing. And then once you add a second sensor into it, because there's another ship out there and you don't know where these guys are when you first show up, you very quickly come to the conclusion, like, you're not hiding behind shit, except in very limited circumstances. You're certainly not doing it and moving anywhere at the time. Distance works out, but depending upon your technological assumptions, the defender might also have a long period of time to look. You know, we can do a total sky sweep now. Takes a while, but, you know, astronomers do that sort of stuff all the time. The question is, how long is it going to take them to do? Now it might take days. It's not unreasonable to think that by the time Star Trek rolls around, you could do a total sky sweep with optical instruments in, you know, 15 seconds, if you got enough instruments pointed in the right direction, right? Low observable stuff. Yeah, okay, that works in space to some degree. But, you know, there's a question about exactly what you're going to do with your waste heat. I am not, there is a group of people in the community that believe that there is no stealth in space. I'm not one of them, because all those statements come with technological assumptions behind them that they don't really explore. For instance, if you've got a tactically useful FTL drive, you can get inside the other guy's OODA loop. And so, yeah, maybe he can find you eventually if he's got enough time to look around. But if you're constantly on the move, he never gets enough time to look around. He can basically kind of figure out where you've been, but that doesn't mean he can figure out where you are now, which in turn leads to some interesting things that I call gun kata in space. If you've ever seen the movie Equilibrium with Christian Bale and Sean Bean, where basically they're having gun battles where they've done enough statistical analysis of how gun battles develop that it's basically the equivalent of, I'm going to shoot in this direction because there's a high probability that a guy's going to move into the path of the bullet in the next 5 seconds.
Which is every World War II dogfight ever.
Yeah, kind of. The difference between, you know, in if you're doing something like a dogfight, it's different than just leading your target, right? Leading your target is, I see the guy and he's moving in this direction, and so I'm going to shoot ahead of him so they arrange. This is a case of, I'm not even necessarily looking in the direction I'm pointing the gun. I just know that there's, based upon my analysis of how this battle is developing and how other battles have developed, I know that there's a good chance that at this point, the guy that's hiding over there is going to try to make a break across to the other place to get a better shot at me. And so I shoot in the direction that he might be moving through at that time.
Yeah. You saying the comment of not necessarily even looking in the direction that you're pointing your gun, while I fully take the meaning of what you're after there, I got to say there's more than a few of us who have had that private and have had to remove them from the range lest they become a danger to themselves and many, many others. That I know you didn't mean that as a comedic aside, but I did have to throw that in there because, God, I've seen too many of those dudes.
Yeah. I understand what you're going through. I mean, Christian Bale is in this movie, his character is widely recognized as being like a 10th degree black belt in gun kata. He goes in and starts a battle where, like, before the battle starts, he's got to fight like 10 guys. He says something to the effect of, yeah, I don't know if I can pull this off. We're going to see. Maybe this will work. Maybe it won't. Of course, he's the star, so it does. But you know, occasionally you run into science fiction that's based upon this. The Exordium series by Dave Trowbridge and Sherwood Smith is basically gun kata in space. There's a more sort of simplified version of it in Robert Chase's The Game of Fox and Lion. Kevin O'Donnell's Fire on the Border has some elements of this, like they've got a tactically useful FTL drive and they're seeing things out of order. That's one of the things that implies if you've got speed of light sensors, but you're jumping around. At one point they say, okay, another ship just appeared at such and such a location. There is a 75% probability that it's the same ship that we're already watching. It's just, we're now seeing something that happened in the past before it came closer to us. So we're seeing events out of order.
Because that's when the light got to you based on them jumping around faster than it being out there. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can do, like, one of the things that you can do in the Exordium universe is time on target attacks where you know that there's a target basically in the center of a circle or center of a sphere, and you take a shot and then you jump to another place on the periphery of that circle, and you take a shot, and you jump to another place. It's not, you're not actually jumping to the periphery because you have to take into account the time delay, but you're basically setting up a situation where, you know, three shots are going to come in at the same time that were fired by one ship that fired them from three different locations.
Yep.
So it's not just, you know, I'm going to do the trick with the artillery piece where I, with the automated artillery piece where I change the angle of the gun and it spends more time in the air. But all of those shots came from the same location. These are shots that are actually coming from different locations.
From different locations.
And so when you look at that, does any of that sound like modern naval combat? Does any of that sound like World War One or World War Two naval combat? No, but people just sort of use the terms and sort of run it through the science fiction converter without even bothering to turn it on for it. And, you know, that's – I'm not saying that that's bad per se. What I'm saying is – if you're going to do that, you should know that that's what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're probably doing it more for narrative purposes than for necessarily any sort of attempt at, you know, again, air quotes around the word realism, because we're talking about space combat. I know right now Mike is just trying to figure out which earthbound naval vessel the Klingon Bird of Prey was named after. What class of ship that's supposed to be.
Well, the Bird of Preys are interesting. Or, I mean, they sort of fit outside of that. But, you know, that's more of a – so part of the problem –
I know. You were just talking about the copy-paste the ship class names. And so I just wanted to make fun of the Bird of Prey. That's all. That's the only place I was going with that.
The D7 is always called the battle cruiser. I'm glad you mentioned Star Trek because
it's not a battle cruiser.
It might be. It kind of depends. I mean, I always got the impression that it was very fast, but didn't necessarily have good shields. And that, you know, I can look at that and see a World War One British battle cruiser in that description. The thing about Star Trek, though, what makes Star Trek really both interesting and hard to have conversations about along these lines is that Star Trek is really inconsistent across any given iteration of it, let alone all of them.
Yes.
Especially when you go from the original series to all the stuff that came after. It's like, you know, it's almost like nobody... It's almost like Gene Roddenberry, when he created TNG, had never actually seen the original series, because they changed all the fundamental assumptions. And then even within TNG, they're all over the place about stuff. And I've gotten to the point where when I'm asked what my favorite version of Star Trek is, I always say
careful.
Yeah, I know. But I'm going to cheat. I always say Star Trek SO. And they go, S.O.? Yeah, Sternbach Okuda. So okay. my favorite version of Star Trek is the one in the Star Trek Technical Manual, the Next Generation Technical Manual, and the Deep Space Nine Technical Manual, et cetera. And one of the things, I've been going through that stuff for, I'm part of a group that does a show on YouTube on the Aries Studios channel called Starfleet Tactical. It's Saturday nights at 10 o'clock. We've done 21 episodes as Starfleet Tactical, and then I did like another 4 as Axanar After Dark before that, before we actually sort of formalized it as a recurring concern. And
yeah, I've seen a bunch of the Axanar shows before you guys started the formal one. There's some fun listens.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun to do. And so Pat Doyle, one of my two partners in crime in that are Alec Peters, the guy who does Axanar. The guy behind Axanar, and my fellow BU9 member, Pat Doyle, who's a Federation commander, 3-time national champion. He's an airline pilot in his day job. He's another member of BU9. He's a war game designer. He, as I put it, he can fake being interesting. But he and I and our friend Andy Presby, who works at NASA and who's got a... He's a former submariner with a master's degree in spacecraft design from the Naval Postgraduate School. We've been going through, looking through all that stuff to try to sort of figure out how some of this technology works. And one of the things that we've discovered is that if you go back to the Holy Writ of the Star Trek Next Generation technical manual and you read the explanations that Sternbach and Okuda have given us on how these things work, all of those different technologies, there's like a one or two sentence explanation that people use, the most famous of which is the transporter breaks you down into energy and then beams you to another place and reassembles you into matter. Yeah, none of those explanations actually are really a good summary of what is in the book.
Yeah, close enough.
Close enough for a lot of stuff. But the thing is, the devil is in the details. And that's where you get into the, well, you know, if they can do X, why can't they do Y? And the answer is, they really aren't doing X. It's just the, you know, the summary, the TV guide version of what they're doing says that they're doing X, but that's not really what they're doing.
To bring some of this back to kind of the core shtick of what we do here with the Mentioned on Dispatches stuff, how do we enable some of this stuff on the tabletop? Like, how do we actually game through some of these things? You know, one concept that you had mentioned that's a fairly interesting one is the idea of a ship, you know, the tactical level faster than light drive that allows you to basically sort of skip around the battlefield, for lack of a better analogy. You could fire three shots from three different places that all land at the same time. How does one enable such a wackadoodle idea to be played out on the tabletop somehow to actually game this?
It's funny you ask that.
There are lots of weird ways to do things. Are there any good ones?
It's funny that you asked that question. I'm going to tell a little story. So many, many, many moons ago, in the 1990s, I am put in touch by my friend Fred Kish, who's a fellow member of U9. He puts me in touch with a game designer named Chris Klug, who used to work for SPI, and then he was at Victory Games. He's the guy who did the James Bond role-playing game.
Yep.
And then he later did Earth and Beyond, if you remember that multiplayer online game. And he's now a professor teaching war game design stuff, computer game design stuff at Carnegie Mellon University. And so he put me in touch with Chris because Chris had done a little bit of stuff on the periphery of science fiction, but he'd never really done science fiction at the point that we were talking. This is before Earth and Beyond. And he was looking for inspiration, both fiction and nonfiction, that he could read. And so Fred introduced me and this Air Force officer who was big in traveler circles, and Winchell Chung to Chris Klug. And so I gave him a bunch of suggestions, including the Exordium books. And I had extra copies of it because I'm such a big booster for this series that if I found extra copies, I would buy them so I could give them to people. And I sent him one of my precious sets of the Exordium five book series. And Chris reads it and he goes, "This is really cool, but I don't understand. Can you explain to me what this is?" And so I give him a long explanation and I CC Dave Trowbridge on it. And I send it back and I said, "Here's what I've got." And I'm CCing the author so that he can tell me if I got any of it wrong. And Dave comes back and says, "Nope, you got it right." And that's basically where my friendship with Dave was born, out of this email trying to help out this other guy understand Dave's books. And Chris goes, "This is great. This is great. I want to make the game that I'm doing about this. I want this to be the game." And I go, "Yeah, there's no way you can make that work." Because what he wanted to do was a design a manual game that would get turned into a computer game that would later come out as a board game. He said, "There's no way we can make this work because it's not just multi-blind. It's not just double blind, it's multi-blind. And it's multi-blind with events occurring out of order. Because as you're moving around, you're seeing the events out of order because all your sensors are operating at the speed of light. But the ships are moving faster than light. So there's no way you can do this on the tabletop." And I talked him out of it. And then a month later, I figured out how to do it.
Okay, so how do you do it?
This goes back to, you have to kind of go back to that old discussion between design for cause and design for effect.
Yeah.
You can't design for cause. You can't replicate all the steps here. You have to design for effect. And I looked back upon a couple of games, one of which I had been familiar with for a while and one of which I'd only recently discovered. And those two games were GDW Star Cruiser, which was the board game that was that went along with the 2300 role-playing game, described as Submarines in Space, and the game from Avalon Hill called Attack Sub. And what those two games taught me is you can show everything on the gaming table. The question is controlling whether the players can use the information or not to achieve a combat outcome. And so you can sort of summarize the approach as, until you've built up your sensor picture, your negative modifiers are so strong that you can't hit even something that you're right next to. And that's how we
start. You don't
know
it's there.
And so my friend Arias Kaufman and I designed the game that way. We designed it so the idea is that when you first start and you're at contact level zero, that means that your information is so bad that you actually have a negative hit probability. And you have to acquire positive modifiers to bring your two-hit probability up to the point where it's even worth rolling the dice. And you do that by making sensor rolls over time. And so we had 30-second turns, but the idea is that the actual movement is only taking place in about 5 seconds, 6 seconds of that turn. The rest of it is you're sort of sitting and oriented and getting stuff, and then you're getting ready to do your next jump, and then you do your next jump. So you're not staying still for very long. And what's really going on here is you're doing Hunt for Red October, right? Ramius always turns to starboard at the bottom of the hour. And that's exactly what you're doing. You're soaking in electrons, soaking in photons, and going, okay, we know it's an alpha-class destroyer. He seems to be running this set of tactical algorithms because we're collecting all the data as he moves around, and we're getting it out of order, but the computer's putting it together. He seems to be running this particular set of algorithms. He's got this particular flaw in his drive. When we match it to the data book, it's Ramius, and we know he always goes to starboard at the bottom of the hour, and so we're going to be there when he pops out. And we get the shot. And so we represent that by you make sensor rolls over time. And as you make these sensor rolls, your contact level goes up, which has the effect of giving you a better hit modifier. And since it's pre-plotted movement where you plot multiple subphases, you start getting to see parts of the other guy's move before he executes them and before you finish moving. And if you've got a real big advantage on the other guy, you get to see like 2/3 of his move before you plot the first part of yours.
So the initiative goes to the guy who moves second, not unlike some of the BattleTech games would do for you in a tactical sense. Let's shift topics here slightly some and get away from the big space combat kind of stuff. And let's get down to the individual level, down to the man-to-man kind of thing. Mike, I know you're a big RPG dude. You and I think, are working our way through several of the same fantasy books, right? The fantasy RPG games right now that we're reading through. But also, nobody's gonna knock us for loving a good sci-fi game. If we had Aardwolf on here, we could talk Traveler for like 5 hours. Some of the individual level sci-fi things, Henry, I think those are probably a little closer to where your books live.
Yes, my books really will translate far better into RPG adventures than they ever would translate into any kind of a war game. Because, well, bluntly put, I learned how to write being a game master. I learned what worked in stories. I went to the Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson School of Writing and learned what I know about storytelling from the beginning, doing game mastering, and eventually then shifted over to actually writing and expanded my skill set from that. So by that pretty much definition of how I learned to write, you can expect that RPGs are far more likely end results from my book.
Yeah. A question, the obvious question is, in your various gamings over the past 10 years as you've been cranking out the books, have you actually converted any of them to an RPG adventure, a particular set piece, even just only in your head? Have you tried to figure out, okay, so this would work really good for this game, but this might not work so great in this game, of the different sci-fi franchises and available game systems that are out there?
I actually went the other way. For the Undercover Captain, which is the second of the two Captain books, the first one being The Counterfeit Captain, which is my Lost Generation ship novel. But The Undercover Captain, I basically took perhaps the single most successful RPG campaign I ever ran. It was using the Margaret Weiss's Serenity system, in other words, Firefly. So it was set in basically the Firefly universe. And I did not write a Firefly adventure, but I did lift the whole plot that I ran seven characters through for about 5 years and condensed it into that book. It was perhaps the easiest book to write that I ever had because I knew what was going to go on. I knew which direction I was going. I'm really pleased with how the book came out, but people who read it won't immediately think Firefly. There is no real Firefly connection to it, but that's where I lifted the adventure. But beyond that, yes, I troll science fiction RPGs all the time. I've got one called M-Space that's on the way right now because I'm hoping that it will provide some good ideas and spark some stories or help me develop some ideas that I've already been working on. So it's really a back and forth, but I love the RPGs for that reason and because, you know, they're fun.
Yeah, I think there's plenty of us that enjoy reading a good RPG book for setting info as much as understanding the mechanics and kind of looking for some good ideas in there. I think there's plenty of us that fall into that realm. Mike, we mentioned before going on the air, you've got Forbidden Lands right now. What else you got right now that you're reading on the book front, the RPG front?
Oh gosh, as far as RPGs go, I'm like you with your Kindle. There's so many RPG books on my Kindle right now that it's hard to even think of one. One of the newer ones that I'm reading through is it's a solitaire one, so there's no surprise there for you, Brent. But it's D100 Dungeon,
okay.
So it's a fantasy one. But science fiction wise, other than I'm actually playing in a game of Star Trek, the role playing game. If you want to talk about old RPGs, but I don't think I'm reading anything science fiction wise right now in the RPG world.
Dude, I'm the youngest guy on this call right now. They're all old games for us. I mean, at this point, they're all old games for us. So I was just, you know, again, knowing you're a big Trek fan, and then you had sent in the Starfleet Marines unboxing, you know, a while back for one of our unboxing days. I didn't know if you'd had any of the sci-fi games sort of front and center that you were poking through right now.
Obviously, well, you know, it's interesting that
you went for your channel.
You know, you mentioned Starfleet Marines, and I was thinking as Chris was talking, because there's an example of where, you know, I'm reading through the rule book for that, and to me, it's World War II combat cut and paste. And as I'm reading through the rule book about, you know, cover and fire and opportunity fire, all I can think of is this is Star Trek. What if somebody has a transporter? how do you defend it? They don't even talk about transporters, I don't think, if I've hit the section where they might, I don't know. But and so I'm thinking of the Star Trek universe, and they're just focused on ground combat. And it kind of like, you know, and they'll talk about you have stun settings on some of these weapons, and it just means a unit can't move for a turn or two. But It's almost like when you try to talk about some of the more technical things, it's almost like they don't want to even go there, you know? And I don't know if it's because it's like you were talking about earlier, Chris, where it's just too hard to try to come up with something that would replicate what they're showing or what supposedly should be happening in that universe. When you're trying to do it on a 2D game map. Yeah.
Yeah. When, you know, there's envelopments on a two-dimensional plane, which is basically warfare up to the dawn of flight. And then there's vertical envelopments now with, you know, helicopters and airborne units and whatever. The point at which you can cause an instantaneous envelopment, though, right, by transporting yourself behind somebody, hey, just beam those guys down into the enemy's rear, that's a very different world there. You know, that's suddenly open.
Or you transport a big bomb over their heads and blow them up.
Yeah, that's a whole new realm of tactical possibilities right there. So that does get pretty different. So Henry, just out of curiosity, has there ever been any movement towards any sort of official role-playing game adaptation of your book universe? Have you approached anybody? Has anybody approached you about any of those? Or is that just not something that's on the radar right now because you're too busy writing?
With the books, it's not on the radar at all. I actually talked to several people way back in the 80s when I was writing comic books about the comic book characters that I was writing. But there's been no discussion with anybody about doing anything with the books. Although, quite frankly, if anybody was going to do it, I think the Scout series is probably the most likely of the bunch because it can mix. Most of the books mix swords and airships. So anything that can do that, I think, would be a lot of fun with an RPG. I have been tempted to try adapting any one of a number of systems to run those myself, but that's about all that's really gone.
I think your default answer to everything these days is Savage Worlds, isn't it?
I don't run Savage Worlds, and I've never played it.
Yeah.
If it really came down to it, if I was going to do the Scout series, I might do the Ubiquity system.
Yeah.
And if not that, this is one of the reasons I'd ordered M-Space, because it's supposed to be a sandbox style game that will work if you want to do a 1940s style solar system with Martians and Venusians and all that sort of stuff, all the way up through just about anything. So I'm looking forward to getting that one and taking a look at that. But there are plenty of systems out there that should be pretty easy to modify to work with at least any of my games, because they're fairly straightforward. If you've got something that's handling something cinematic, like the old West End D6 Star Wars system without the Force, or the Ubiquity system, then I think with some minor modifications to it, you could run most of my book.
And then we call Chris for when we've got to actually have some ships shooting at each other, or maybe not.
Maybe, I don't know. I'd probably lift the ship combat from some other system and see if I couldn't modify that to make it work with whatever I was running. But anyway, part of the problem is that my wife plays in all of these games and she doesn't read my books. So I don't know how interested she would be in playing any of those. She's not a science fiction fan, really. So I tend not to drag her into too many of the science fiction games.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally understand. So going back to some of the Star Trek theme again, because you know, I've got three Trekkies on the call here with me.
Watched all the Star Treks.
Huh?
I've watched all the Star Treks.
Chris, you mentioned that one of the Star Trek Tactics video series that you work with are the guys working on Axanar. I know that there's been some legal wranglings over whether or not Axanar is even going to be allowed to get made at this point. Within the context of the Star Trek universe, what do those guys sort of hue closest towards if somebody was looking for a frame of reference? If any of the audience doesn't know much about it, what does that lean closest towards? And then Mike, you're going to get to tell us on a scale of 1 to infinity how enthused you are for that eventually finally making it to the screen. So Chris, what's the best frame of reference for somebody that doesn't know much about the Axanar story?
So Axanar takes it's sort of interesting in that it is it doesn't feel like TOS in a lot of ways, but if you think about where it fits in the timeline, it's before Kirk. So for those who don't know, Garth of Izar in the old original episode series was
Lord Garth.
Lord Garth was
right, exactly.
Kirk's hero. When Kirk was at the academy, he was a war hero. Garth was a war hero from a war. I don't think they ever specifically said, but in the Axanar stuff, it's purported to be a war with the Klingons. And he ends up on this insane asylum planet for the last like 7 criminally insane people in the galaxy. And so it's that character. This is the story of him being the war hero. And the They did a 20-minute short that functioned as the trailer, and they were going to do a full feature-length production. But as a result of the lawsuit, they will they're only allowed to do like a further 2 15-minute segments to complete it. So instead of being a 2-hour-long thing, it's going to end up being about a 50-minute-long thing. When they're fine.
Boo, boo, boo.
As somebody who has been a supporter of Axanar from the beginning, that irritates me no end.
Exactly.
It irritates me a little bit too. But they've done great work with the sets, etc. You know, a lot of fans don't understand that getting sued by CBS and having to defend yourself from a lawsuit, etc., can throw your production schedule off. They are currently, I think they've got like 3 days of shooting they have to do, and they had it scheduled, and then we got the lockdown. So at some point they're going to go out to California to film some stuff they have to do that are outside scenes that they know exactly where they're going to do it. It's just a matter of getting it done. They've filmed all the interior stuff. I have not seen anything that hasn't come out on YouTube. I did see a script early on, but I assume that that's what they did. But to be honest, I haven't actually asked Alec if there were any changes after the last time I saw the script.
I'll be honest, I thought it was completely dead. I didn't think that there was any more movement on it. So I'm glad to hear that at least there's something out there.
No, they're still planning on doing it. They're still planning on doing it. I mean, they're going to finish it up, and Alec is asked this question every week, and every week he gives the same answer, and it basically boils down to, we got 3 days of shooting in California. We're in Atlanta. We don't want to do this shooting with masks. So, you know, they've been trying to figure out what they can do in the meantime. And so they've been doing little stuff here and there. Like they got a new camera the other day that, if you're a camera person, it's a red Komodo. I'm not a camera person, but, Alex said it's, you know, it's a high quality, but still relatively affordable. And by relatively affordable, it works out to only a few thousand dollars.
Yeah. Yeah. Four figures, not five.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they've got like some test footage that they did that they turned into a little vignette. There's little things they're doing here and there, and it's still very much alive. Still very much alive. Not on the schedule that they wanted.
There's hope.
There is hope. There is hope. And other people have used their sets to film stuff also, and they've got plans on moving. They're currently in a space that must have been some sort of automotive thing, because it's got big doors, like in a shopping mall, it doesn't have pits, so it doesn't seem to have had like mounting brackets for big things to lift cars. So I'm wondering if it was like a place that did replaced your glass or something like that. I spent 4 hours there one day because we were waiting for the rain to stop on the, you know, corrugated metal roof or whatever it is. It basically was like being in a snare drum for several hours, waiting for the rains to stop so that we could actually record an interview with me.
That's not unlike the primary exhibit hall at Origins in Columbus when a good rainstorm blows through.
Yeah.
It feels like you're in a snare drum. I think we caught one of those one year, didn't we?
We did.
It was just like that. We were there. So there was some of the volunteers were there, and we were assembling sets because they had this stuff all set up in California, and then they moved to Atlanta, and they were getting, this was like April 2019. And so they're getting ready to do the shoot of the stuff. And so they wanted, it's like, you know, we're sort of hanging out here. We're waiting for the rain to stop. Let's go ahead and assemble the captain's quarters set. And so we, at some point we're trying to figure out what all the pieces are, because this stuff was taken apart on the other side of the country. And most of the people there had never seen it before. So it's like, okay, I kind of okay, all right. You know, for a while there, we forgot that it's a pie piece. And so the walls aren't parallel. Once we realized the walls aren't parallel, everything fit a lot better. And we're moving stuff around and trying to figure out how it all works. And all of a sudden, all of our cell phones go off with a weather alert that there is a tornado warning. It's like, okay, so we're on a concrete slab. If this tornado comes through this area, we're dead.
To get under some cover.
So, but there, you know, it's like we'd have to get in our cars and drive to cover, you know, so do we stay? Do we leave? Do we do? What do we do? And we talked about it for very quickly back and forth. And I finally said, you know, screw it. If my tombstone reads killed by a tornado while assembling a set for a Star Trek movie, I'm totally okay with that. At which point we all put our phones away and went back to, you know, hand me the drill.
Hand me the screwdriver. Yeah. Struck by lightning while working on. Yeah, totally get it. So we need to figure out how to sneak Henry onto the set as an extra.
I think they're done filming that stuff, but getting you onto the set shouldn't be that hard. If you are anywhere near Atlanta, we can probably make that happen.
See, Henry,
okay.
Here I am making the magic happen for you.
So,
all right.
To go back, I realize that I never really answered your question, which is basically describe how the combat works in this a little bit. And so the answer is that it's, you know, in the original series, combat took place at very long ranges. And that's really because it was too hard to shoot both ships in the same frame. By the time Next Gen rolled around, they had a bigger budget. Technology had advanced to the point where they could have both filming models in the same range, same frame, and not have one of them be out of focus. And as a result, the combat became a lot closer together. This is really more like that. A lot of what you see is them dogfighting with starships, like you saw it, like Wolf 359, and what like you saw multiple times in Deep Space Nine. It's really more that style of combat.
Well, their most recent trailer showed a Klingon ship and whatever the ship design they made, the Axanar.
Yeah, the Ares class.
Ares class, that's it. Dodging through an asteroid field and at X-wing TIE fighter range.
Yeah, it's very close. And you know, the special effects are fantastic. The special effects guy they got is just fantastic. And they sort of turn him loose and let him do stuff. And it really looks pretty good. I will admit that I have a certain fondness for this idea that if you've got ships that have sensors that range in some cases across light years, and they can move at these tremendous speeds, and the energy that is implied, you know, they're mixing matter and antimatter as their power source. The energy levels they've got, you should be able to reach out and touch somebody at ranges longer than, say, a World War II dogfight. And so, you know, I love everything about Star Trek, but I also kind of like, in some ways, I like the original series better because I think in a lot of ways it sort of fits in with the technology that I see a little bit.
Yeah, but let's also figure out as well, though, that some of those things are concessions to the audience that isn't as geeked out about the high-tech implications as we all might be. And they are folks that are far more interested in, show me something cool on the screen. And there's not a lot cool on the screen about the captain on the bridge of the Enterprise saying, you know, all right, shoot down that Klingon, and that Klingon is so far beyond visual range that you don't even see the explosion for 9 minutes after the round is fired.
Well, so the solution to that was contained in another show by Gene Roddenberry, and that is Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda.
Andromeda, yeah.
Where if you think about how combat works in that system, you'll have two ships that are like really long distances from each other. I think I came to the conclusion at one point that some of those battles are basically one ship is at the orbit of Mars and another ship is at the orbit of Jupiter and they're firing at each other. And
Jupiter's probably isn't unrealistic given the technology available to you.
Yeah, and you know, that's the equivalent. Jupiter's about twice as far from the sun as Mars is. So, I mean, that's a huge, huge distance. And so what you saw happening is, you know, you see them, they've got them on their sensors, they've got them on their tactical displays, etc. You see the one ship fire, you see the other ship fire, they cut to the tactical display, they're watching the ordnance coming through and sort of the ordnances passing each other, coming in. And then you start seeing point defense fire from one ship and point defense fire from the other ship. And then you start seeing hits taking place. And so they're cutting back and forth. And at some point in the middle of that, they always cut back to the captain giving orders or something like that. They're cutting around, but at no point did they ever show the whole battle on one screen, because it would be tiny little blips on a radar display type thing, right? You couldn't see any of that stuff. So they're doing close-ups. They just didn't feel like they had to have everything in the same frame at the same time.
Yeah.
And it really kind of seems to work. I think it works just fine. And it's also, you know, I work with David Weber in the Honorverse. If you think about it, that's kind of what you, when you're reading a battle in the Honorverse, that's kind of what you're reading, right? Those missiles are in flight for long periods of time. They are not in the, you know, if you're doing this in television, they're not at point blank range. In fact, there's a big deal made about how when Manticore came out with the multi-drive missile, what a tremendous advantage it was to be able to extend their firing envelope, and about how it was a game changer during the course of the first war with Haven. And so, you know, it's a style of science fiction combat that A, makes a lot of sense to me, and also B, it seems to be consistent with the technologies that we see.
Yeah. We are running out of time tonight for getting this whole thing recorded. You know, we generally ask for about an hour of folks' time, and we're a little over that at this point. May come in a little under by the time I'm done editing, but we'll see. With regards to some of the sci-fi combat, sci-fi gaming stuff that's out there, Chris, do you have one or two particular favorites? Mike, Henry, I'm going to ask you guys the same thing. Quick and dirty, are there one or two particular favorites that you've just really loved over the years, or that do something that you really like?
Oh, that's a good question.
Or do you need to think about it, and I'll go bug Henry and Mike and put them on the spot?
Yeah,
let
me think about that real quick.
All right, Mike.
You know mine. You know what I'm going to say. It's
I know what
battles.
You're going to say, but the audience doesn't know what you're going to say, so go ahead and spit it out.
It's Starfleet Battles, and that includes its newer incarnation, Federation Commander, I think it is.
Yes.
Or Federation Commander, and Klingon Border, I think. But yeah, it's basically Starfleet Battles. It's just updated rules. But yeah, it's Starfleet Battles, and I can't think of, you know, we had this discussion earlier, Brent. There's not a whole lot out there really that, you know, science fiction wise in the war game community, and Starfleet Battles certainly, I think, is a war game. So, and Talon's the other one. I own Talon. I've never tried it because I can't get past the fact I've got to write on a counter. but Starfleet Battles, hands down.
Yeah. So the Amarillo Design Bureau one, though, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
just
yeah,
making sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Making sure we're on.
I'm thinking.
On the right
what other one is he thinking? What else is he thinking of? Wait a minute. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, there are a variety of Star Trek games throughout the years, but that Starfleet Battles license has lived with the Amarillo Design Bureau guys for what, 40 something years at this point. I mean, they've had it for a long time.
They've had the rights to the first technical manual, the Franz Joseph, I think it was.
Yes.
And
yeah.
So their universe is a little more restrictive than the entire Star Trek. Actually, I prefer that universe. it's a lot more restrictive what they can do with it.
Yeah, and you may not be the only one, but just I wanted to clarify for the audience. Again, like, I knew what your answer was going to be, right? But the audience doesn't, and so I wanted to get that out there on the record, so. Henry, I know you've done a ton of gaming out there.
I have. However, the as far as science fiction board gaming, the last one I remember playing was Stellar Conquest, which is why I'm going to talk RPGs. Although it's worth noting, I have Talon in the closet next to me also, and I also haven't gotten into it, but it just has been a time issue. But for me, I'm much more of an RPG gamer when it comes to the science fiction. And I will just come down and say, and this is, you know, there's so much that goes into what makes a game work. And part of it is getting a good set of players and a good set of rules helps. But my two favorites are probably West End's long departed and much, in my opinion, lamented D6 Star Wars system, and then the Serenity, now Firefly. I'm trying to remember what the Weiss base system was. It wasn't Cypher, because that's
Monty
Cook.
Yeah, and by then they had moved off the Sovereign Stone system, but I can't think of. I'm like you. I'm stuck for it, and as soon as somebody would say it, I'd go, "Oh yeah, that's it." But
yeah, I'm going to be the same way, but. But it's those two systems, and it's a combination of the fact that I thought the systems worked very well, and I enjoyed running them. They were cinematic, but pretty easy to run from a game master point of view. I always like a system that doesn't get in the way of telling the story and having the adventure. And neither one of those, in my opinion, got in the way of that. So those are probably my two favorites. And a lot of that is, again, just the fun that I had running those games and the fun that the people had playing them.
I will say, so I'm going to be the unpopular dude in the room and say, from an RPG front, I actually quite enjoyed the old TSR Star Frontiers game. I know everybody likes to boo and hiss because it wasn't Traveler and that was the big game at the time. But I had a lot of fun playing the Star Frontiers game. I did have a lot of fun with the Justifiers RPG the couple of times that I had played it. That was a little bit weirder, and I think that system wouldn't have been very portable. It would have only ever worked for that particular setting. But it was an enjoyable one. Of the newer ones, something that I think folks, I hope they don't sleep on it, the Falling Stars game from Lock and Load. The Falling Stars game is a hybrid, both role-playing game and tabletop game. So you can just focus on the combat piece of it and play it as sort of a mini skirmish game. There is some space combat involved in there. It is a role-playing system with legit character advancement, character improvement. But honestly, one of the best parts about that Falling Stars, the background of the universe in which it exists, just like the first four paragraphs of background of the setting, has like 14 different hooks in it for different plot points that you can use. Sort of humanity started colonizing the stars, started launching a whole bunch of ships out there, had some initial success with these distant colonies, and then nothing. Like everything completely shut off and went totally silent. And now it's like 100 years in the future and they're trying to figure out what happened. And there's more to it than just that. We're just running out of time on the podcast. But it's... There are so many great ideas in sort of the background hook of this game that it's fantastic. And there's just some really neat concepts in there. As far as like actual wargamey kinds of things, I'll always sit down and play some BattleTech with people. I can always be convinced to sit down and, you know, some giant battling robots and, you know, sort of blow each other up with some of those things. That will never not be fun for me. So, Chris, did you come back with something?
Yeah, so because my science fiction gaming over the course of the last 10 years has been sort of described or punctuated by not playing any one thing a whole lot. That having been said, I think at the strategic level, the thing that I'm most likely to pull out and want to play again is Eclipse, although... GMT Space Empires 4X is one that I need to dust off and do some work with.
That's a fantastic game.
Yeah, I've only played it once, and it was a good enough experience that I bought all the expansions.
Yeah, that's a good
game. Then the probably at the tactical level, I mean, there's Full Thrust. There's a lot of different options there. The old Star Trek FASA Starship Combat Simulator has some fond memories. But I'd probably say Triplanetary in the race scenario of Triplanetary, which we always play with the armed spacecraft. It's one of the games that literally lives in the trunk of my car, so that I've always got it with me and can always pull it out and introduce somebody to Triplanetary. And I supported the Kickstarter, got the new one. I love the fact that they added a couple of rows of hexes out beyond Jupiter to fix the map, but I'm not happy with the fact that they made the hexes so damn big because then they ended up making the board so big that it doesn't fit on your table. And then on top of that, they didn't fix the other major problem with the map is that that's a game where you really have to draw hex center to hex center when you're drawing your course on the map. They didn't put dots in the middle.
Not helpful.
So, you know, I bought the new one, but the one I'm most likely to play is the old one.
Yeah. I think it says a lot about us that when asked to talk about some of our favorite sci-fi games, we're all naming stuff that, you know, is old enough to drink. And probably double that, that is all, you know, in the 30 to 40 year old range. And, you know, probably not necessarily that they haven't improved on those designs, but more likely that those were just the ones that really caught our attention and we haven't gone looking for too much different since then, or just had such good vibes with those that why bother? So,
well, you know, I played Star Trek Ascendancy lately. I've played it twice now. And it's, my first thought was this game isn't Star Trek because it just kind of looks like it's Star Trek. But I decided I was okay with that. And it's actually a more interesting game than it looks like because there's actually two games taking place. You're building the map by putting down pieces on a table and then putting warp corridors to connect the various pieces. So there's the map, there's the game of going and conquering your neighbors, but there's this second Go-like game of when you create the spatial geography, you're trying to like muscle other people out so they can't put their pieces down.
Yeah.
And when I saw people playing this at cons and stuff, I totally and completely missed out on that second piece of it. It never occurred to me. It just sort of looked like it was some sort of, like it was a gimmick. And it's like, no, this is actually much more important than a gimmick.
Yeah. Well, clearly not. Although, you know, again, there are plenty of things that people thought were gimmicks that turned out to be pretty useful.
Yeah.
So escalators. So.
Yep.
On that note, guys, thank you very much for joining us. Real quick, Henry, next book is going to show up when? Any idea?
I know the next book is going to be a sequel to Fortune's Fool, which is under the name Jeff Boyd. It will be out, well, as soon as I can get the cover finished and waiting for the artist to come in with that. So probably sometime in November, I would think. And I'm going to go ahead and drop this, that we are planning sales on most of the books on Amazon, the ebooks, obviously. They will be ongoing by the time this is live. So if you go out to Amazon.com and search for Henry Vogel and a reasonable by me, you'll find quite a few of them have been dropped to 99 cents or $1.99, and a couple of them will even be free.
We're going to link your page to this podcast.
So okay, cool. Just go to my author's page.
But he will not link Jeff Boyd's page. That's different.
It's very sad.
We're not going to make him do too much work there. So... okay, so books on sale, go check them out along the way. We've got some new ones coming. And for folks that follow Henry Vogel's author page on social media, you also get some previews of the book he's in the process of writing because there'll be some chapters that he posts online on a pretty regular basis. Henry also posts lots of cool daily sci-fi artwork. I've even thrown a couple of them at him. Last week was Impractical Space Babe Clothing Week, so that was entertaining. I guess it'll be a couple of weeks ago by the time people hear this.
Yes.
Next book will be not too long away, the next Henry Vogel book, by the end of the year, perhaps.
No, it'll be end of next year. I'm writing it right next now. Year.
Yeah. Okay. Chris, next sci-fi convention you're showing up at, even if only virtually.
So right now I don't have any on the schedule. I just did Capclave this past weekend. So I don't know what my next virtual con is going to be.
Well, we're going to bring you in for the next virtual Dragoons convention in January when we get around to that one. Going to call you for that one because we are going to expand the speaker panel a little bit for that. But who knows, maybe we can even get you into a game of Triplanetary on like Tabletop Simulator or something.
That's possible. I'd love to do that. I'm planning on hosting so I've been associated with the Connections Conference, which Brant's also been to a few times. The online version of Connections US was such a hit that I'm going to actually do a virtual global Connections from now on out, it looks like. I haven't really started putting it together, but we're sort of aiming for the end of March. And so it'll be, this is a professional Wargamers conference. So this is the like DoD types, et cetera. But yeah, we're going to do it. The plan is to do it through YouTube. And so anybody can participate. Everybody can go to YouTube and watch the panel discussions, et cetera. And then in addition to that, I'm doing Starfleet Tactical every Saturday night at 10 o'clock Eastern time on the Ares Studio channel. And Pat Doyle and I are planning on launching our own YouTube channel that would be more presentations oriented, because we both have some things to say about the intersection of the real world and science fiction. And, you know, I worked for the Navy for a long time. He's a naval reservist, and we've got lots of things to say. So
there you go. Mike, My Own Worst Enemy just started the solo series, but you've also got some other stuff that you've been working on. So I got it. The camera attacked Napoleon, and so that game sort of fell apart. What's next after Solo Babble? What's the next thing coming up on My Own Worst Enemy?
I'm probably giving away spoilers here, and it's interesting. You mentioned, I think, an upcoming mention in Dispatches with Hollenspiel, because my next My Own Worst Enemy episode, gameplay wise, will be Horse and Musket: Dawn of a New Era. So that will be that'll be something to look for. And I do want to end this mention in Dispatches with one kind of semi traditional thing we do here. Someone mentioned M-Space, and I went to Drive-Thru RPG to look at it. And I just want everybody to know that Drive-Thru RPG is having a Halloween sale right now. So this is where we all run off and spend some money now.
So, Mike, you realize that tradition is really only in effect when you're on the call.
That's true.
I'm
maybe Aardwolf and.
Well, yeah. So, it is not unheard of for games to be discussed on Mentioned in Dispatches, and by the end of the broadcast, it has been purchased by at least one, if not multiple, members of the panel on the show.
Or at least wish listed.
Yeah. I already have purchased several M-Space products. I haven't read it yet, okay, though.
But Brett and I will just wishlist them for now.
All right, guys, thank you very much. From left to right on your podcast dial, we'll say goodnight to BB Mike. Thanks, Mike, for being here. Talk to you again in a couple of weeks when we come back around to some role-playing stuff again. Thank you to Henry for taking some time away from writing all the different books that he's busy juggling. And Henry, thank you for joining us tonight.
You're more than welcome.
And Chris, thank you for elevating the level of geekery around here to an entirely new dimension. We really appreciate the level of detail that you bring when talking sci-fi stuff. So thank you
for having me.
And so, audience, thank you very much for joining us for this episode of Mentioned in Dispatches. We will catch you guys next week with who knows what, because I don't have the calendar right in front of me. So we'll see what comes up after this. Thanks, everybody. And we're going to call this good night.